Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And let's go back to where we left off the last show about consciousness and move forward with our guest who's back again, who's wonderful, a wonderful scientist and metaphysical explorer, to help us understand consciousness in better and better ways. And we'll get a little bit more metaphysical this time. And I'm so excited to have Shelley Joy back with us. Welcome, Shelley.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be able to add some more to the conversation here.
Sure, because you've explored it on every level, on very spiritual levels as well as very scientific levels. And I love all your books. You have so many books about it, and they keep coming.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was really taken when I was young by the school I went to, who was trying to talk about interdisciplinary studies. It was the California Institute of Asian Studies at the time. Now it's the Institute of Integral Studies. They changed their name. But even originally, the idea was to approach, try to understand both science and religion and mysticism, taking an east-west approach, taking the best of Western science and mysticism, like Steiner, et cetera, and Asian philosophies, primarily India. But they also had Tibetan teachers and Chinese teachers and Japanese teachers. This was back in the mid-70s, where I studied for my master's degree in comparative Asian studies, and I focused on Indian philosophy. And all of this happened, I think I've mentioned many times on your show before, as a young electrical engineer, fascinated by science and wanting to do things like invent time machines and things, seriously, when I got out. But I experienced LSD back when it was semi-legal and didn't have a bad reputation, but because I had heard that with LSD you could communicate with God, and I was a ham radio enthusiast, and I wanted to communicate with God for a number of reasons, partly because I was transgender, and I thought God had made some kind of a big mistake, and I wanted to learn more about it somehow. But anyway, I was open to taking the entheogen, and that changed my whole career from totally focusing on science, like most scientists and engineers do, to focusing more on philosophy and religions, because it was consciousness, to me, was like the new frontier, and it still is. I think among scientists, they know less about consciousness. There's so many theories that mostly focus on how neurons are wired in the brain. And generally, they think consciousness doesn't exist outside of biological creatures, whereas philosophers, even modern philosophers, many of them are panpsychists, and panpsychism believes that consciousness underlies the universe, that the universe of space and time objects springs out of an underlying consciousness that was there before time and space were even invented by that consciousness. So anyway, today I'd like to talk more about mysticism and how, to me, what we call mystics and shamans and saints, they're really the scientists. They've always been the scientists of consciousness. They've really been investigating what is consciousness and where did we come from and where are we going. And they've been looking at the big picture, the panoramic picture of what is consciousness. Whereas scientists, which my roots come from, science, engineering, and physics, it actually looks at less and less. It looks at smaller and smaller slices of reality to measure it with instruments and come up with logical theories. But they're not really looking at the big picture.
The big picture is multidimensional because it actually moves into implicate reality and through the Fourier transform in ways that we've talked about in previous shows, that consciousness is not just in our brains or no matter how smart our brains are, we actually are only really smart because we're drawing on the universal computer. And what I was thinking about earlier today was that artificial intelligence will never get beyond this computer of the brain, or what they think is the computer of the brain, trying to be smarter than the brain. But I can't ever imagine artificial intelligence delving into mysticism. So that'll come back to you now, and understand that we're dealing with a consciousness that can explore mysticism, because we really are, all of us, human is a mystic, and operates through the mysteries of the universe.
Yes, and the key to it all is direct experience, not book knowledge and logic that science is based on primarily, but direct experience. And unfortunately, the scientists threw out the idea of direct introspection in the early days of psychology with William James, who was exploring consciousness himself experientially. He would take laughing gas, what we call laughing gas, nitrous oxide, and he tried opium and hashish. But he was a brilliant doctor and sort of polyglot of many, many scientific disciplines. But by the 1920s, when the Russian Pavlov came along, they started thinking that, oh, the only kind of knowledge we can really get from psychology is to observe things. We observe behaviors of animals, and we do statistics, and we can't do direct introspection like William James did. However, the mystical scientists, the one I mentioned, who are saints and shamans, et cetera, through centuries, through the millennia, they've been exploring consciousness experientially, the same way I did with the LSD when I was 21. And very few scientists do that. The few that have, actually, have gotten quite excited about consciousness. In fact, Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert got too excited, and they tried to spread the experience of entheogens, psychedelics, LSD, first of all, in the Harvard college students that they taught, and then, of course, it got held up in public newspapers and media, and it spread throughout the country and the world, and it terrified the establishment, and also scientists were pretty upset because they were unable to sort of explain why they shouldn't do research on this. And then in the wisdom that's often missing among politicians, they totally shut down any research on experiential exploration of consciousness with entheogens. But still, there are many, many schools of consciousness studies in Asia that don't require any use of drugs or entheogens, unless you consider tea. I mean, the Chinese Buddhists discovered tea really help them stay awake for long hours at night and meditate, practice jhana. And so really tea is a drug, as is coffee, but right, we tend to have our weird ideas about what's a drug, what's not, you know. I mean, in another universe, maybe coffee would be a Schedule I drug along with cannabis. But getting back to the main issue, I wanted to talk about my upcoming book being released in November called Tantric Psychophysics, which actually focuses upon the science of consciousness as developed through Asian traditions, primarily India and Tibet. And it's been, you know, I started out studying Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. I started getting into yoga within a year after experiencing the LSD and getting all excited about consciousness research. And I heard that yoga helps you develop ways to open up to different levels of consciousness and become much more healthy. And so being kind of a nerd, I read lots and lots of books that I could find on yoga, and I got really interested in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, which is a classic in how to develop your consciousness and to get to higher, what Rudolf Steiner called higher worlds. And Patanjali wrote his sutras, or he actually compiled them from information that was available in about the 4th century. The Patanjali Sutras has eight stages of a person trying to get to a higher state of meditation. We would call it trance. He called it samadhi in Sanskrit. And Sanskrit is a very amazing language because, unlike English, Sanskrit was primarily written and developed to describe very rare states of consciousness. So they have words for different states and stages of consciousness that we really don't even have in English. So unfortunately, without those words, we can't really focus on them. So we tend to use Sanskrit words, and sometimes those Sanskrit words turn off scientists who might be interested in learning something from consciousness. So we're at a point in history where we need to start developing a more a language of consciousness that is we can be articulate enough to discuss it, even between different religions, because every religion has their own terms for different things of consciousness. So what I've tried to do is bring together Patanjali's theories from the 4th century and a Tibetan teacher who wrote 5 books in the late 1800s. This is like 1,600 years after Patanjali. So in all of the 16 centuries, there were mystics in Tibet who were exploring consciousness and coming to new discoveries and writing them down very clearly in their texts. So what I realized with the tantric Tibetan tantric mysticism, as it's expressed in recently, is really much more advanced than Patanjali's yoga sutras. So people could begin with yoga and then slowly go into the Tibetan path, which is very, very practical. And I'd be glad to discuss as quickly as I could those steps, if you think we have time.
Sure, we do.
Okay, in my book, I've tried to classify it with 7 steps. When I say 7 steps, it's like a map. You know, everyone needs a map, or really it helps to have a map if you're trying to get somewhere. And so where we're trying to get is to experientially get into a higher state of consciousness to communicate with higher worlds, as Rudolf Steiner taught and many others. And here are the steps. First of all, in yoga, you begin with practices of yama and niyama, which is, these are like most religions teach, you know, to be good, be kind, focus on good thoughts, have a clean body, and things like that. And then the hatha yoga is the 3rd step, where you learn how to stretch your body and get in a good physical shape. And mainly, the objective was so when you sit down and meditate, your body wouldn't have any aches or pains that would distract you. Your body would be very flexible and relaxed, and you could forget about it while you sit in the silence and darkness to meditate.
But what if you can't do that, for instance?
Well, then you're stuck down there at that stage. But if you're like, a quadriplegic, you could actually do it even. I think anybody could, unless you're in pain. If you're in chronic pain, I think it'd be very difficult to meditate. I may be wrong. Maybe for an advanced shaman or yogi, they could do that. But the idea to really get to higher stages of consciousness, you have to be able to let go of your body and your sensory systems, your normal visual and auditory and tactile sensory systems, and stop your thought, your thinking, your in words, and stop your memory. Normally when we get in a quiet space, even if you go jogging or something, or you're sitting on a bus without anything to read, your mind will pop up things for you to work on. It's almost like when you're looking at your computer screen trying to read something, and a big window pops up, you know, with an advertisement for something to do this or that. And you have to clear the window to get back to what you're doing, and it's an interruption.
Right.
Well, the normal mind does that too.
But what if you had a float tank? Have you ever done a float tank?
Yes. I was fortunate to be able to work with Dr. John Lilly back in the 70s, who developed he called them sensory deprivation tanks. And I built one in my loft in New York, down in the Lower East Side. I didn't have the water in it. He put salt water, and he warmed it up to just below the temperature of the body, like to about 94 degrees. And so you wouldn't feel much difference in temperature. It would be very stable. It would be very dark, and it would be very, very soundproof. And he would, he did it primarily on himself at first, and he would try different drugs, and he would also try meditating without drugs, but he found it more effective to take something like ketamine, and sometimes he took LSD, which was legal back then, when he first began his experiments. He first tried to work with dolphins, but he was trying to be able to communicate with dolphins without human language, of course, but through empathy, through empathic communication, or maybe electromagnetic communication. He had all kinds of ways of detecting what was going on in the interaction between a human and a dolphin. But anyway, I'm getting far off the track here. What I wanted to say was I'll very quickly go through the seven stages that I've mapped out for someone who's trying to cross over into really experiencing the non-duality of the universe. So you start out with doing the various hatha yoga and pranayama and breathing exercises and getting healthy. And then you start to learn to practice meditation. Meditation, as I said, is quieting down the mind, stopping the memory from popping up, and kind of gaining control of the mind. It took me a few years of practice to get more than 5 or 10 minutes of mental silence. It's a lot harder than people imagine. You sit down and try to be quiet, and like I say, your mind keeps popping up with ideas until you learn to let go of them. You can watch them come up, and then you let them go. And this is popularly called mindfulness. There's many mindfulness techniques these days that are fairly popular. But getting beyond that, once you are able to really quiet your mind, something called samadhi will emerge at some point. It means that you become aware of everything at the same time. And you try to do this. It's an effort of trying to quiet your mind, your normal mind, and becoming more aware by listening with every facet of your consciousness. And actually, it's trying to activate a new sense, which I call supersensible perception, and which Patanjali calls siddhis. Siddhis are powers of perception that are above normal ones. So once you're able to sort of slip into this samadhi, you can start focusing on different areas of your physiology, like your heart center or your throat center or the center of your cranium or your abdomen. The Russian hesychast mystics used to focus on their abdomen while they said something called the Jesus prayer over and over. But the idea is during samadhi, you're focusing consciousness on an area, and it's causing that area to grow and to begin to grow and blossom and activate. So the idea is there are several different ways of perceiving things that are not sound and vision and touch, but they're mediated through the chakras, what the Sanskrit word is chakras, and they're centers a perception that you can develop through focusing on them with samadhi. And this is a long thing that the Tibetans actually developed also, is trying to go to the generation and the completion stage of developing these chakras so that they could then explore the universe of consciousness, I would say, with or without entheogens. Right now in the West, many people are trying different types of entheogens, from psilocybin to psilocybin mushrooms, to LSD. And some of them are even becoming finally legal in the countries that they're being used in. I think in the state of Oregon, in the U.S., over here in the West, they've legalized all drugs, even from heroin and cocaine. They're just trying to make, if people become dependent on one of them, it's a medical problem, but it's no longer illegal to experiment with things. So this allows doctors and people researching consciousness to begin to use some of these entheogens. And what the entheogens do is activate the chakras sort of very quickly because of the very unique energies that these hydrocarbons give off when they're in your bloodstream. You know, any complex molecule in your bloodstream, which is hot, the bloodstream is around 98 degrees Fahrenheit, they break down. So when a molecule breaks down, a hydrocarbon, very complex molecule like LSD or cannabis, it emits a spectrum of energies, of electromagnetic energies, that interact with different parts of your body and allow you to actually see and perceive a wider range of experiences than you normally do with your normal vision and hearing that's processed by the brain. There are higher stages even beyond this.
Right, but this might be a coming time of higher consciousness that our whole planet is moving into, and we might all find it much easier to attain these greater awarenesses in the future.
Yes, because these energies are flowing through us. You know, every human puts out 5 watts of electromagnetic radiant energy. Every time the heart beats, it's putting out electromagnetic energy. Some of it is heat, but some of it is pure electromagnetic frequencies, which you can see with a night vision goggles. You know, you can see a human being glowing from a couple miles away with night vision goggles, what they used to call sniper scopes and things like that. So we're broadcasting electromagnetic frequencies, and there's 7 billion of us. So if you multiply 5 watts by 7 billion, you have 35 billion watts of energy. This is like radio waves girdling the planet, the entire planet, in a spherical way. And that is what I and some other people believe is what Teilhard de Chardin called the noosphere. The noosphere is the current living electromagnetic region of the planet that is a living, growing kind of a repository of all of human feelings and thoughts. And it's a higher level than our individual consciousness. It's sort of a collective consciousness. Within it, it has lots of levels itself. So there's different levels of the noosphere. You know, one of them might be, say all the people who love President Trump. They probably have the very similar frequencies, and they're tuned into that, just like being tuned into a TV station like Fox Channel or CNN. You can tune into the noosphere, and that's part of what the Tibetans discovered through developing their siddhis and their chakras. They found that they could use these to tune. Stage 6 in Tibetan is called Trekcho. It's called pristine cognition. In other words, they're able to see what I believe Teilhard de Chardin called the noosphere. It's the level of above the biological sphere of our planet. You know, we have the geosphere, the biosphere, and the noosphere is this electromagnetic consciousness that pervades the atmosphere that we're feeding with our 735 billion watts of energy that our hearts put out. Right. And all of these things can be tuned into.
Right, and there must be particular frequencies that attract people to particular circumstances, like people who love President Trump, and the rest of us don't know why, and it's because somehow there's a frequency that allows that in certain people that
exactly.
We don't understand.
Yes, exactly, and even more than that, each one of us humans has a unique frequency. In my books, I call it the holoflux frequency. Each one of us has a unique imprint, just like we have a unique, everybody knows, I think, that we have unique fingerprints. You look at the complex.
There's also common frequencies that we find in each other, which creates community and love and partnership.
Yes.
And relationships that we're
exactly.
attracted because of those frequencies. And we're unfortunately, you know, there's so much to talk about that we're getting near the end of the show. And
Let me say one more thing. I'd like to say one thing. There's something called darshan in India and Tibet, where if you get close to some holy or highly powered consciousness person, you pick up their holofax frequency. In other words, you're learning their phone number. So if you hug someone or you're really close to them, then when you're far away from them, you can actually call them through the noosphere because you, your body, we know the, their phone number in a way. So, you know, it's, and you can do this with people who've died and gone into the noosphere, no longer have their biological bodies. That's how people still communicate with the dead. And that's how they had seances back in the 1800s a lot, which I think are coming back, by the way.
Yeah, good. This is so fascinating. And unfortunately, I wish we could just keep talking, and we certainly can in future shows. Shelley Joy, what? Give the audience some contact information.
Well, you can even email me. The email is on my website on one of the pages, and I'd be glad to answer. I have answered a lot of emails. My website is www.shelleyjoy.net. Shelley Joy with an I, shelleyjoye.net. Shelleyjoy.net. And I have a lot of paintings and books and recordings,
beautiful
interviews, and stuff like that.
This is so fascinating. It's so terrific to talk with you, and I'm looking forward to continuing this journey to understand the metaphysics of consciousness. So, thank you.
Yeah,
so
we didn't get to the last step, so next
time I'll talk
about the final step.
Yeah, there's so much more. Good. So, thank you so much for being back on Energy Stew.
Welcome. Have a great day.
You too. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org. I'd love to hear from you, and thanks so much for listening.